Welcome, everybody. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm the director of the Africa program here at CSIS. We're very pleased and frankly relieved to see the launch of the final version of our report, Africa Policy Beyond the Bush Years, Critical Choices for the Obama Administration. This is an effort that began last April. It's been a fairly comprehensive and very participatory process that put this book together. It entailed a great deal of effort, first and foremost from our authors here, a lot of time and focus, but also from a broad swath of Africa policy experts, many of whom are here in the room. First and foremost, I want to say a big thanks to our authors. Joel Barkin, who did the piece on democracy, retired now, a senior associate with CSIS. Mark Bellamy, who's the director of ACSS, now wrote an excellent chapter on security engagement. David Goldwin of Goldwin International Strategies, a piece on energy security. Ambassador Princeton Lyman of the CFR, whom probably everybody knows, a chapter on trade and assistance. Phil Nyberg and Steve Morrison, a chapter on health, global health policy. Michelle Gavin, who I don't believe is here tonight, did a very good chapter on kind of the big looming challenges, environment, demographics, and so forth. And finally, an excellent wrap-up summation by Ambassador Chet Crocker. Let me say, these authors put a lot of work into this. As I said, it was a very collaborative effort. Members of the working group probably are too numerous to thank, but they included congressional staff, corporate representatives, public health experts, advocacy, and NGO representatives. Very much a bipartisan effort drawing from a wide swath of expertise, and we're really grateful for the time and insight that everybody gave to this effort. In addition to the working group meetings, we held a series of closed, off-the-record meetings with members and former members of the Bush administration. These were tremendously valuable. People gave significant time to this, offered very candid reflections on what the achievements of the Bush administration had been, what the challenges they faced, and some of the limitations of U.S.-Africa policy. This is well beyond the call of duty for a number of these folks, and considerable time, as I said, dedicated to this. These included former Assistant Secretary Jendai Fraser and Walter Kansteiner, Teresa Whalen at the DOD, Florizel Lazier, not sure if she's here tonight, Bobby Pittman at the NSC, Todd Moss and Phil Carter, David Gordon, Tim Shortley, all at State Department, Maureen Harrington and Malik Shaka at the MCC, Mark Dybul at OGAC, Senator John Danforth, who shared his reflections on the Sudan peace process, our own Ambassador Johnny Carson, who at the time was a National Intelligence Officer for Africa. There's more on that later. And a number of other key people from the administration over the years. We wanted to say thank you to those members of the Bush administration. Some of them are here. Mark Green, I think, is here. Ambassador Mark Green. Paul Applegarth, first director of the MCC, Mike Miller. We're really delighted to see you back, and we want to thank you for all your engagement over the last 8 years. The result of this big effort, I think, is a very balanced, comprehensive report, and we hope it will help the new administration to build on the achievements of the Bush administration, harness the growing constituencies who are interested in and concerned about Africa, and build a smart power approach that is anchored by sustained, robust diplomatic engagement. Earlier versions of the report were released to the transition team. There have been chapters up online, so I'm not going to go into great detail. You have the books, I think, most of you. I'm not going to go into great detail on the conclusions, but just a few themes that I'd like to pinpoint. U.S. engagement in Africa, obviously, over the last 8 years has grown much more expansive and much more complex. It's driven by mounting recognition of U.S. strategic stakes in Africa, new constituencies here, bipartisan support in Africa, and importantly, I think, the leadership of President Bush. New resources, new institutions, PEPFAR raised the bar in many ways on development assistance. The MCC, a really innovative model, AFRICOM that pulls together kind of the disparate strands of MIL-MIL engagement. All of these were new. The new administration, I think, has an opportunity to build on these achievements and I think has the challenge of ensuring that expanded U.S. engagement is appropriately balanced across these various areas. This means HIV versus other health challenges, health versus broader development challenges, humanitarian programs versus programs that invest in trade and investment capacity, military versus non-military security, balancing short-term tactics and crisis management against longer-term ambitions and opportunities. So managing this complexity and getting the balance right requires several things from U.S. policy, three things, I'd say. First and foremost, it requires robust, capable diplomatic engagement. You can't do this with an understaffed Africa Bureau, with a development agency that appears somewhat adrift, and with embassies operating with serious deficits in personnel. Second, it means strengthening multilateral diplomacy, coordinating better with the United Nations, the African Union, European partners, the so-called new players in Africa, China, India, some of the Asian players. And these are on issues that concern us all on peacekeeping, crisis diplomacy, transnational threats, and development challenges. Finally, it requires strong, capable, and accountable African partners. I think a reprioritization of the democracy and governance agenda is vital. Governance is at the core of every U.S. interest in Africa. And it's most difficult but most important in those countries in which we have important security or strategic stakes, whether they be energy, conflict, or counterterrorism concerns. I think one of the pleasures of working on Africa policy is that it's not victim to deep partisan divides. I think the greater division is between those who recognize that Africa warrants sustained, coherent engagement and those who are not quite there yet. I want to say one thing before turning to Steve. I want to say a very special thanks to our program coordinator, David Hennick. Anyone who's worked with our program over the last 2 years knows what an incredibly efficient, thoughtful, and hardworking professional he is. He's been a tremendous asset to the program and to this particular effort, substantively, logistically, and so forth. He's leaving for law school at the end of this summer, and so we're all bereft. But thank you, David, for everything you've done for this. I'll turn over to Steve Morrison.
Thank you, Jennifer, and good evening. I'm Steve Morrison. I had the pleasure of working with Jennifer and pulling this project together, and I want to single her out for the extraordinary effort that she put into particularly in editing these chapters into what I think is a very, very nice core. I think that Africa is special as a zone of U.S. policy. It's one that we can have a special pride in, and many of you in this room, including many of the civil servants and foreign service officers, should be especially proud because there's such enormous continuity and commitment in this room towards Africa policy, and as Jennifer has said, it's something that crosses many divides and unites us. It has this special aspect, and that's part of what I think has attributed to the remarkable achievements of the last several years and the prospects that we're going to see more looking forward. We did enjoy a very generous reception from the Bush team. Jendai Fraser, Walter Kansteiner, Bobby Pittman, Todd Moss, the list goes on, gave very generously of their time and their thoughtfulness in looking at, in recounting and reflecting what they had experienced in commenting on some of the drafts that we presented. We also called upon many other people who are here, like Mark Green, Mike Miller, and others, to help us. I have the pleasure here today of introducing Johnny Carson, our new Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the Department of State. He's entering a pretty amazing moment, really. It's one in which there's high expectations and hope for the Obama administration. The Obama administration's already gotten out of the box in certain very important respects, the president going to Ghana in July, the Secretary of State going to Kenya in August, a new global health initiative, a food security initiative, an evolving food, an evolving education initiative, all of which are going to impact, all of these are going to come together. The fact that we had Morgan Tsvangirai here this week, very telling, very significant indicator as well. Johnny has agreed to come and speak for 10 minutes or so around sharing his thoughts on looking forward in this period on Africa policy, and has kindly agreed also to take a few questions from you at the close of that. He is among the most distinguished American diplomats. He's known to, I'm sure, everyone in this room. His era of service goes back several decades. I first met him in 1987, shortly after he had been working with my then boss, Howard Wolpe, who's with us today. Howard, in his role as chair of the House Subcommittee on Africa, Johnny had provided integral input in a very delicate moment in the early 80s, and then had gone on to Botswana as the DCM in that late 80s period. And what was clear then and still clear today is that this is a man of boundless energy and passion about Africa and thoughtfulness. He's a very passionate and considerate individual and has remarkable leadership capacity that we've seen through the years in his role as ambassador to Kenya, to Zimbabwe, as a principal deputy assistant secretary in the late 90s, which was a very turbulent and trying period. We don't need to go into all of the different shocks that we experienced in this period, but Johnny was very much at the helm in that period of the embassy bombings, of the Congo War, one of the darkest and most stressful periods in which I believe our approaches actually hung together to a significant degree because of his determination and commitment in that period. In the last several years, he patiently took on the duties of being the National Intelligence Officer and fulfilled that role brilliantly. And to the Obama administration, the Obama campaign, and the Obama administration's credit, they recognized his brilliance and commitment early on and began to rely on him. And this is one of those great success stories in which his passage through Congress to this moment happened and without any interruptions or terrible setbacks. So we can welcome him to his post today. So please join me in doing that.
Thanks very much, Steve. I don't know if people can hear me or not out there, but what a kind and thoughtful introduction. First of all, let me say how pleased I am to be here at CSIS this evening with all of you as you participate in this book launch. To Jennifer and Steve, you've done a marvelous job here at CSIS, serving as the conscience and think tank for much of the thinking that has gone on with respect to Africa policy over the last 8 years. It is greatly appreciated, and it is also reflected in the quality of the book. It's a little daunting sometimes to be standing up here and talking to this audience, and I see so many faces and friends out there. You've already mentioned Howard and Reed Kramer and others that I've known for many years. But even to be up here next to this panel, and as I look down from Joel Barkin to David to Princeton Lyman and David and Mark and probably the doyen of this group, Chet Crocker, there's probably no less than probably 200, 225 years worth of African. collective African knowledge here at this table, and that is reflected in the quality of the book that has been produced from front to back. When I agreed to come this evening, I told Steve that I would not, in fact, come with any prepared remarks, and basically say just a few things. And it's certainly not a time for me to have any retrospective comments or critiques of the past administration. I will say one thing I think that Chet put in his book chapter, and it said, build off of the past. Don't tear it down. Look before you jump in and build on what's good. The past administration did leave three important marks, and I think Jennifer referred to several of them. But let me underscore that PEPFAR stands out as an extraordinary political and health initiative. It put us in the forefront of dealing with Africa's most important global health crisis, HIV/AIDS. It is up to any new administration to build on that, not to let it flag, because health care remains an important issue throughout the African continent. Second, I think that MCC is critical and important as well. It's a new way of putting development assistance money into the hands of important and needy African states. We need to look at that, support it, and build upon it. I will put an asterisk here and say that the creation of MCC should not be used as an excuse to eliminate USAID. Both serve a very important purpose and fill important development gap niches around the continent. There is a need for an MCC, but in my opinion, there's also a need for a good old-fashioned USAID, and I hope that both will continue. I think that the other important aspect is AFRICOM as well. It is an important new element, and it's not going to go away, but must, in fact, be used effectively as a part of U.S. foreign policy, not the lead role in U.S. foreign policy. It is an element of what we do on the continent. That's a little bit of looking back, but let me look ahead just a little bit. Some things need to be done and are starting to be done. One is engagement by the new administration. President is engaged, involved, and I think Michelle Gavin was intending to come. I spoke to her a couple of hours ago, but she's actually a lot busier than I am sometimes. Michelle, are you here? Hey, she said she was coming. But Michelle can also testify that the administration is engaged. Just in the last several weeks, and including this week, today, for example, to give you an indication of what the secretary is doing, 2 hours ago, she met with the Senegalese Foreign Minister Gadio for about 35 or 40 minutes, talked to him at length about his efforts ongoing to resolve the problems of return to democracy that we're wishing and hoping for in Mauritania. She also discussed with him a number of other issues about regional concerns and also about Senegal's effort to get an MCC compact. Democracy was also on the table. But earlier in the day, she spent a good 35, 40 minutes with Morgan Tsvangirai, who will be meeting tomorrow at the White House with President Obama. Again, a wide-ranging discussion. But these are not just one-off occasions. In the last several weeks, probably under the radar, it shouldn't be, but it mostly is. There has been the first meeting by the president with African head of state, President Kikwete was here. Secretary met with President Kikwete. She's met with former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to discuss issues related to Zimbabwe, to Sudan, and also Kenya, where he played a very important role. She's met with the Angolan foreign minister and had very good talks. And she has called a number of other counterparts in Africa. There is, in fact, a lot of movement. Steve mentioned that the visits that are coming up, mentioned that the president is going out to Ghana, the first time that we have seen an American president engage so early in an overseas visit to a African country. And hopefully these kinds of visits will become more routine. It does not have to be the annual grand tour. It can be a visit like the one going into Russia, one-off, visit a country, going to or from someplace else. It should be integrated as a part of what we do. I think Chet, in his chapter, said that Africa policy should be mainstreamed. It should be a part of our daily thinking, not just the preserve of simply thinking it is the responsibility of the Africa Bureau. But the other bureaus ought to also be concerned about our African issues as they talk to diplomats in Latin America, the Middle East, and Europe. But we do see the president going, and he's setting up the agenda. But we will see the secretary travel to AGOA first week in August. And she has committed herself to making several other stops as well. I won't say where they are at this point, but she is committed to doing so. But even beyond that, if the secretary is getting out early, the deputy secretary of state probably will get to the continent before either of those two senior-level visitors. So we not only have a visit by the president, the secretary, but we've also got a trip teed up with countries identified with the deputy secretary traveling to the continent. Diplomatic engagement also extends to the fact of Special Envoy Scott Gratian getting out of the blocks quite rapidly, three trips already out and around the region working on the Sudan policy. There is energy, there is dynamism, and it's not just travel. If there are any African diplomats in the audience, they will know that yesterday they were convoked to the State Department to get the first indication of what will be, we hope, one of the administration's signature initiatives on food security. An extensive briefing held over a two-hour period to talk about where the administration wants to go in dealing with the issue of food security and agriculture and agribusiness. Some of you have probably heard me talk probably too much about this, but, of course, I believe this is one of the lacuna, not just from the past administration, but for many administrations some time back. Agriculture is important. Some 70% of all African households depend either as a primary or a secondary source of income on agriculture. Some 40% of the GDP of every African country is based on agriculture. It is a thing that employs today, as it has 20, 30, 40 years ago, the most Africans around, and many women as well. But the Green Revolution that helped to transform Asia and Latin America has not yet come to Africa. And if Africa is going to make progress, it has to deal with the whole spectrum. At the bottom, we have to reduce poverty by increasing agricultural production, and we have to use agricultural production as a way of generating greater export earnings and greater business enterprise. is very important. And I think that the initiative that the administration is working on will roll out more formally in the days and weeks ahead will be one of those important new areas. I think there's also a strong commitment to dealing with issues of energy and environment on the part of the administration. That is a global issue. There are winners and losers in the environmental situation that prevails around the world, and Africa is ill-prepared to deal with some of the environmental problems that confront us all. And I think initiatives in that area may also be forthcoming. And thirdly, one thing that there will be certainly a great deal of stress on is the issue of conflict and conflict prevention, conflict mitigation, very important issues. There's no doubt that while conflict around the continent has decreased rather substantially in a number of areas, we see in several parts of the continent persistence of conflict. Conflict in the eastern Congo, conflict in Somalia, conflict in Darfur. These conflicts undermine the ability of states to do the things that states are supposed to do, and that is provide security and opportunity for all of their citizens. But we find that conflicts are pernicious, and they generally are largely things that can spread across border and generate real problems. I think you'll see a commitment to by the administration to try to do early prevention, to get in, try to stop them before they occur, if they occur, to mitigate them, and if they do happen, come in and support them or support the resolution in a equitable fashion of what's out there. One of the early signs of this, I think, is a visit that both Michelle and I made shortly after I was sworn in. I took off immediately for Africa. Second stop was Nairobi, Kenya. Michelle joined me out in Nairobi carrying a special message from the president. We went and we met with all of the senior officials, all parties, civil society, cross-basis of folks, and expressed our concern about the problems that we saw that remained unresolved since the flawed elections and the violence that occurred in January and February of 2008. We did it because we could see things sliding down. They had not yet reached crisis point, and they had not moved from crisis to political violence and instability. But the only way that you can prevent the worst things from happening is by getting in early. I think we will continue to do that. I think the efforts of Scott Gratian on Sudan are illustrative. I know myself that I've been very, very seized and involved in Mauritania. Foreign Minister Gadio's visit here today from Senegal is an extension of the work certainly that I've been doing and others in the department over the last 3 or 4 weeks trying to help him resolve that situation. I certainly have been on the phone to most of the senior leadership in Mauritania, including some that I will not name. But we hope that that our actions will help in this regard, and certainly on the issue of Somalia, which is of major concern to us. I have certainly been active out there. Let me conclude by doing quickly two final quick notes, and then I'll stop, Steve. You know, people ask, what are we going to focus on? Some of it is, a lot of it is is a little bit of the same things that you've heard before, but they remain important. Strong effort at promoting democracy, rule of law, and good governance. Got to be critical, absolutely critical. Second is crisis prevention. As I said, doing as much as we possibly can to prevent and mitigate and resolve conflicts. Third one will clearly be an effort to focus on strengthening economic development and fighting poverty throughout Africa. And a fourth issue, clearly out there helping Africa deal with a whole host of transnational issues that the continent faces, new ones and old ones. Some of the new ones clearly are climate change. Some of the new ones are the spread, the rapid spread of narco trafficking. We have a situation today in Guinea-Bissau. People were saying that it probably was first Africa's first narco trafficking state. If you've been watching the news, we've seen a president, an army chief of staff, and just this past weekend, two senior former government ministers, including a presidential candidate, all gunned down. It is possible, and I'll make the statement that it's possible that in the next several years, Guinea-Bissau could easily become the West African version of Somalia. It is a situation where drugs and drug trafficking have become a major problem. But it's not just there. It's all up and down the West African coast. And, in fact, drugs are increasingly a problem in places like East Africa and also South Africa. And one can get into that in some detail. But these are the kinds of transnational issues that have to be dealt with, because they will serve as a cancer and eat away at African society. One of the things that is also very, very important, moving beyond the transnational issues, as we deal with issues related to Africa, we must not forget that Africa has enormous, and I stress that, enormous untapped potential. While we are dealing with some of the small brush fires that are out there, we have to carve out time and effort and energy to plant trees, to help Africa achieve its enormous potential. And we've got to make sure that we don't only deal with the negative parts. We've got to be active and supportive of all the good things, of all the good things that are happening on the continent. And we have to do it all over the continent and stress that as a major factor. Good things are happening. We've got to find them, endorse them, support them, and promote them. And I'm going to stop, and that's my quick spiel.
We're running a little behind schedule. I apologize for that. We'll run our panel, our roundtable, which follows immediately, till about 7. Let's take one round of questions here.
Just three
questions right here. We have microphones. John, and right here, this gentleman here, and this gentleman here.
Hello, Ambassador Cochran. I'm David Chiffron. I'm right now working with the Partnership to Cut Hunger and Poverty in Africa. Okay, I'm just wondering, you know, I heard that just recently I read that Kofi Annan plans to meet with the Kenyan government to try to pressure them to become more forthright with instituting the necessary accountability in the post that they had agreed to in the post-election environment. And he said if not, he was prepared to forward names to the International Criminal Court. And already you have Bashir, who's gotten an indictment on that. I'm just wondering whether these instances might sidetrack the U.S. policy from dealing with, the major, governance issues, development issues, health issues, crisis issues. Whether this new attempt of trying to indict political leaders in Africa might result in some sidetracking on the part of U.S. policy on what really counts, in other words, and on what really matters to the public at large.
I can answer that one quickly. No, it will not sidetrack us. And I think that that those individuals who do things illegally should in fact face justice and prosecution for them.
Mr. Carson, thank you for your comments. I wanted to ask you, I applaud that your focus on agriculture, but I want to push you a bit further in terms of land tenure issues. Countries I know best in the Eastern Horn and even in Ghana, land tenure issues are a total mess. And the core of local politics, and I don't understand how democracies can survive with that ticking time bomb. So I hope that you or your administration will focus on those issues.
John, good point. Well taken, and certainly we'll pass it back.
Hi, Dill Osman from the Voice of America Somali Service. Ambassador, I just wanted to ask you, you went to the IGC Italy meeting recently on Somalia. So I wanted to ask what was the resolutions that have come out of that? And also, Italy has decided to open up its embassy in Somalia. Is the U.S. going to follow suit?
I did not go to the meeting. My deputy, Phil Carter, went to the meeting, and we're active participants. A number of countries pledged money to support development initiatives in Somalia whenever those initiatives can get off the ground. Currently, it's difficult, as you realize, to do things like that. We continue to support the Djibouti process. We support the government of Sheikh Sharif. We encourage IGAD countries to support them. And we're encouraging those countries who have a way of preventing assistance from going into the al-Shabaab to do so. But we think that Somalia is at a critical stage. The government of President Sharif needs all the assistance that it can receive. And I'm going to stop because I'm interrupting the program.
Are we on? Yeah, we're on. we have a lot to talk about. The book actually covers a great deal of ground. I am not going to attempt to introduce the speakers because their bios are there. So what I will do, my name is Chet Crocker, and I'm a part of the book, but I just did a few things at the very end. These are the guys and others who are here and gals who wrote in this book and made it the book that it is. We have two basic questions to kick around, and I'm going to ask our panel to spend about 5 minutes on the first question each, 5 minutes each, and then we have a second question. The first question is one that Johnny touched upon, which has to do, and Jennifer and I kicked these questions around a bit over the past few days, and I hope the panelists all got them, but the first set of questions is how do we keep Africa on the radar given what's going on in the world today, given the legacy that President Obama has inherited? It's an easy question. That one we know you'll have no trouble with. How do we keep Africa on the radar? How does it fit? Related to that, what new initiatives are possible? And Johnny's already answered this question in part, but what new initiatives are possible given the crowded foreign policy agenda that we have? And then the third related part of that question is how do we avoid just playing defense? How do we actually have initiatives and not just react to things that come along and deadlines that are set, for example, an election that's taking place? So how do we actually take initiatives and not just be waiting for things to happen? So that's the first set of issues. The second question is one that's, I think, in the minds of many people as they look at Africa right now. When this book was conceptualized, it was fair to say that Africa was a much more competitive playing field than it had been historically, a much more active zone of engagement and competition by various leaders around the world, various countries, various economies, various companies. We now have a global financial and economic crisis. How is that impacting things? How is that impacting the competitive playing field that Africa represents from the standpoint of American policy? So I'm not going to say anything more. I'm going to try and play traffic cop here. And let me just give you the order of speakers who will address these questions. And if there's any time left after the wine, if the wine holds up, we'll go on. But I'm going to first ask Dave Shin if he would say a few words, and then I'm going to go to Mark Bellamy, and then to Joel Barkin, and then to David Goldwin, and then to Princeton Lyman to play cleanup. Dave.
Thank you very much, Chad. I'm just going to try to take a couple of discrete elements of that question because there's so much expertise at the table here. First, and I'm not going to start with the first part of the first question, I want to start with a new initiative and one that has not yet been mentioned by Johnny. I think all of the initiatives that he outlined are excellent ones. But there's another one out there that I think has been very frustrating over the years. I spent 37 years in the Foreign Service. I saw various administrations try to tackle it. None of them really succeeded at it, in my view, but I think it deserves another effort. And that is, how do you engage the American private sector in Africa, particularly in investing in Africa? Now, this is perhaps the most miserable time in the world to talk about investing in Africa in one sense, and that the fact that so many American companies have their own difficulties now. But the fact is that Africa is doing relatively better than North America or Europe is doing at the moment. And there are a lot of opportunities out there. The banking system is sound. They didn't do all of these silly things that American banks did. This is actually a good time to be thinking about investing in Africa. But for whatever reason, it has always been hard, irrespective of the administration, Democratic or Republican, to somehow get a critical mass together that can really energize the U.S. private sector. And it is private, and that means it will make up its own mind as to whether it's going to engage or not. But I think there are ways in which the administration can try to energize the private sector to do more than it has done in certainly the last couple of decades, because it's been a pretty spotty performance in the last several decades. That's point number one. Point number two that I want to talk about, and then I will stop. The issue that Chet raised about how do you get ahead of the problem rather than just reacting to difficulties in Africa, and that has been the tendency, certainly in my 37 years in the Foreign Service, we're mainly reacting. Not too many examples of where I can identify areas where we tried to get ahead of it. Chet perhaps was at the head of one of those principal efforts in dealing with the issue of Namibia and Angola and South Africa and coming up with a really constructive end result. But the number of times that happened in the last 37 years, you can probably count on a couple of hands. There's one effort that I think merits going back and looking at and trying to draw lessons from, even though it really didn't succeed. It was an effort that was designed to do exactly this, to get ahead of the problem. It's called the Greater Horn of Africa Initiative, long since been forgotten. Came out of the Clinton administration, was an effort to deal with two essential problems in what we call the Greater Horn. The Greater Horn included Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, Uganda, Kenya, and the five main countries of the Horn. It was to do two things by the time we finally boiled it down. One was to start getting a better handle on preventing conflict in that region where there was an enormous amount of conflict, and two, doing a better job of mitigating the existing conflict. The other principal element was focusing on food security so that the countries of these 10 countries would not be in the position of having to import more and more food just to keep their people alive. It was a very well-intentioned policy. It failed for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is that new conflicts tended to steamroll whatever efforts were being made to deal with them. Maybe this is too ambitious. Maybe one needs to prune it back a bit, this kind of a concept. But I think there's a lot to be learned from this effort to deal with the Greater Horn of Africa from the standpoint of getting ahead of the curve rather than simply reacting, and I hope that the new administration will go back and learn some of those lessons.
How do you keep Africa, or how do we ensure that Africa stays on the radar screen this year, next year, for this administration? And I'm not sure that's going to be altogether easy. When I think back over my generation, I can think of two ways in which Africa has remained reliably on our radar screen. And one is as a theater of competition with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. The Cold War told us where Africa's place was in the constellation of our foreign policy concerns. It imposed a certain set of priorities for better or for worse. And the other case is post 9/11. Post 9/11, Africa became battle space or prospective battle space, if not in a kinetic sense, at least in the sense that we felt that we needed to compete to defuse extremism, to combat radicalism, to win hearts and minds. In fact, I think much of the surge in assistance that we've seen in Africa over the past 8 years has to do with that competition in Africa. But those the logic imposed by those two situations is probably no longer applicable. And in the absence of those two compelling situations, I'm not sure what how we can ensure that Africa retains the attention of policymakers and commands the resources it needs. I made a few notes before coming here, and I was interested to hear Johnny mention food security. Food security is the top of my list. If there are two issues, I think that will be particularly salient in the short term, food security and the impact of climate change on African populations are likely to be the two. If you consider that these are vulnerable governments for the most part, fragile governments that are dealing with or trying to deal with persistent underdevelopment and questions of poverty and disease and institutional weaknesses and so forth, and you add food insecurity and the enormously disruptive effects on already marginalized populations of climate change, I think you can envision a situation where these governments could be seriously destabilized. And so initiatives to address those two specific issues, I think, would certainly have some chance of ensuring that Africa got the attention it deserved. One other point before I conclude. I was interested in the idea of mainstreaming Africa. I think that mainstreaming is not only a question of making sure that Africa is on the agenda when we talk to the governments, but it's also ensuring that we talk to Africa about the rest of the world. If there's going to be a new if there's going to be global agreement on what to do about climate change, if we're going to sustain and extend the idea of promoting democracy, promoting the rule of law, promoting better governance worldwide, if we're going to have a new world trade agreement, Africa is going to have a role in that. Africa is going to have 50 voices, and increasingly Africans are trying to operate and speak with a single voice. Chinese are certainly aware of this. Others are certainly aware of this. Our tendency, unfortunately, in the past has been to wait until we've got an important vote coming up in the Security Council, send instructions to embassies to go find somebody in the foreign ministry to demarch with a set of talking points that neither side really fully understands. Probably would do well to consider how are we going to engage African governments on these global issues where they are increasingly going to speak and have a voice that is important. And I think that might be a worthwhile project for a new administration.
Okay, thank you. I wrote the chapter on democracy and governance, so I'm going to focus mainly on that and begin by simply echoing what Secretary Carson said. Governance, governance, governance. Now, that said, the challenge here is to really meld in with what I sense is already an articulated policy by the Obama administration generally, and that is, first of all, to be pragmatic and to calibrate the initiatives to what is on the ground. You do not try to push down democratization in countries where conditions are not ripe. We have to make a strategic choice, I think, between democratic consolidation on the one hand and spreading democracy on the other. I opt for the first. And then you adopt other policies that are more in tune with the conditions in the particular countries And a big challenge that we have, conflict has been mentioned on the one hand and democracy on the other. What do we do about these countries in the gray zones, the semi-authoritarian states, the Ugandas, for example, the Ethiopias? These present enormous challenges. And one way we get out in front of the curve on this, to turn to the second part of Chet's question and to not play defense, is to get back to basics in two respects. First of all, the rebuilding of the Africa Bureau itself. This is a bureau that has taken real hits in the last 8 years, notwithstanding the prominence of Africa by the Bush administration and the various initiatives that were articulated in the summary. The Africa Bureau itself needs to be rebuilt. And likewise, USAID. USAID is a shadow of its former self, but there is good news. I was over at the at USAID the other day at a forum on democracy in governance and learned that, first of all, 350 new officers are going to be hired in each of the next 5 years, 50 of them focusing on governance. So rebuilding a basic capacity here if you're going to implement these programs. And finally, in respect to aid, to turn to the issue of food security. USAID used to run one of the flagship programs of the year, the world, in respect to agriculture, in aid itself, and in respect to the support for the consultative group of agricultural research stations. It's a long-term project. It's whittled. It's to some extent been pushed aside by PEPFAR, and that is a real conundrum that we face here, because as good and as PEPFAR is, it has also to some extent taken us off of some key programs that we used to run and that were very effective, and perhaps more than ever, particularly in this food security area, need to be readdressed.
Thanks, Chet. I'm David Goldwyn. I wrote the energy chapter. I have to say, even I think the government is blessed to have Johnny Carson as assistant secretary, because he's wise and he's going to be a terrific leader. But I guess after listening to him, I think it's going to be hard for the non-crisis countries in Africa to get to the top of the U.S. foreign policy agenda, because there are so many areas where there is important concern, like the Horn, like Somalia, like DRC, like Zimbabwe, like Kenya. We didn't hear Angola. We didn't hear Nigeria. We didn't hear a whole lot about West Africa. And I think the reality for Africa is still that some 80% of export revenues come from the extractive industry. Oil and gas are still going to matter to the economy, and the countries that produce them don't get much diplomatic attention and are going to need to. I mean, I think the economic crisis provides a time of great opportunity, because with prices are low, leakage or theft becomes a lot more visible. Budgets are under enormous pressure in most of the producing countries. And so it is an opportunity to show those governments that are willing to engage that transparency can pay, efficiency can pay, productivity can pay. You can get a lot more of what you've got. You can get a lot more competition for what you're doing if you conduct your business in a more transparent way. And I think that's the path forward for U.S. engagement. I think when prices are low and there's not so much vibration about where the next barrel is coming from, it's a chance for the U.S. to have an energy security policy, to formulate what the approach is to the countries in Africa that produce. I think to take a new approach towards governance, which has been step one, building civil society, and that needs to continue. But step two is improving the quality of government to govern. And the fact is that finance ministries and energy ministries are pretty weak at the job they have to do, and the job they have to do is enormous and important. They don't know how to deal with a lot of the major companies. They can't do more than one deal at a time. So the U.S. government with USAID and others can engage in the MCC model with countries that are willing to engage, but I think in a different way, to try and improve sector governance, to work on maritime security. And I think the trick will be that will happen at the sub-cabinet, and it will happen when the Africa Bureau partners with others, because I think it's going to be hard to get that to happen at the top. The real unspoken question is what happens with the Niger Delta. It's not an area of great opportunity. The government is weak, not very easy to deal with, not much prospect of success, but impossible to avoid, too important to the entire continent, too important to the region, too important to the transnational issues. So I think the real question is going to be, is there an intelligent path forward? Can the U.S. make a difference? and then will there be enough of a consensus within the leadership to make an approach on the Niger Delta, even if it has a low probability of success, but at least to put the U.S. on the map as saying this problem has gone as far as it should without external support, guidance, assistance, leadership, suggestion, pick a word that's acceptable to Nigeria, but it's enough to let Nigeria take care of it for itself. It's time to be helpful. And I think the question is, will that make the agenda? And I think that that chapter remains to be written.
Princeton, you have a cleanup, and there's no one who has done more to keep Africa on the radar of this city and many other cities in this country over recent years than Princeton. So that's why I asked you to go last. And a lot of things have been said, Princeton, but you probably found one or two things that haven't been. So
A couple. Thank you very much, and thanks to the organization CSIS for this whole project. Let me start off with something we haven't said today, which is that the United States is not in a position to solve Africa's problems. We're talking as if it's all in our hands, and that isn't true. Not only that we don't have the capability, but much of this rests, 90% of it, in Africa and with Africa, and we've got to start there. I didn't hear any mention today of collaboration with other countries, either with our allies in Europe or with other countries. That's got to be part of our mindset, as well as our collaboration with the Africans. In terms of how you keep Africa on the foreign policy agenda, of course, one way is calamities and crises, which is, of course, the worst way. But, you know, you get narco-trafficking now, as well as the other things. Those are real crises, and they do lead people to think more seriously about Africa. But shifting that emphasis is difficult. I want to pick up on Mark's point about Africa in the world. And there again, we need a strategy that brings together a lot of different elements of policy to address with Africa where they are in the world. We're not on the same page with Africa in the Doha round. We're probably not on the same page in climate change. And the question is, why is that the case? What is it that we haven't engaged in? We didn't hear anything today about trade. My friends from Manchester Trade, who tutor me regularly on this issue, would note that we haven't said anything about trade today. Now, I like initiatives like food security. I think agricultural development's been neglected for a long time, but I hope it's agricultural development and not food security, as if Africans only eat. Africans produce for the market. They produce industrial products. They have to move in that direction. Farmers need to sell, to buy shoes, et cetera. And it goes to a lot of complicated issues. John mentioned land, et cetera. Now, what I worry about an initiative like that, I hear David talking about the food security issue in the Greater Horn of Africa, and it sort of dissipated. About 3 years ago, I read a report of the International Food Policy Research Institute on what are the problems in agricultural development in Africa. Looked at it, and something was very familiar about it. And I realized when I was in AID in 1976, we said the same things. So the question is, can we start an initiative of this kind and maintain it long enough with enough resources, with enough cooperation, 10 years, 15 years, to have a real impact, or will it dissipate because somebody comes up with another initiative or a competing initiative that gets in the way? That's the real challenge in taking on something like that. Finally, it has to link to governance. You can't tackle agricultural development without getting at problems of governance. Who controls the grain reserves? Who sells them on the side? Who controls marketing? Who controls land tenure? So you can't separate that from the governance issue. So it seems to me that for Africa policy, all these initiatives, ideas are good, but they have to be brought together in a more comprehensive way that deals with Africa on the global scene and packages our trade and development elements together in that kind of a strategy. It needs to say, how do you deal with governance? What are you going to say to countries that govern badly, but you want to help on agricultural development? I think we have to be fairly clear on that. Two more other comments. Johnny didn't say today what he said on other occasions, which is it's the key states emphasis, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa. But then up pops Guinea-Bissau. And that's one of the lessons of Africa. You love to concentrate on the big and important countries, but it's the little ones that often bite you in the ankle. And that's just one of the management issues, one of the great problems, and one of the great tasks of and why you need a bureau that is built and strengthened enough to deal with that. The final thing is, where is the initiative? Where is the signature initiative of this administration? If you look at the 2010 budget request, it's like a holding place. It put more for MCC, more for PEPFAR, more for USAID, et cetera. It's all the Bush initiatives, and let's keep them going, which is fine. But you say, well, where's Obama's legacy? What's going to stand out? And it seems to me what ought to stand out, and this trip to Ghana is the perfect opportunity, is to say, you know, it's nothing is going to work unless we see responsible, good leadership in Africa. And I'm pushing that at home. I'm telling the governors they got to spend the stimulus money responsibly. I'm saying that to families in the United States, and now I'm saying it to you. And he's got the credibility to do it, and then he packages programs accordingly. Going to Ghana sent that message. There are a lot of countries just gnashing their teeth over the fact that he picked Ghana. But it hasn't come out yet. It hasn't been the signature emphasis that Obama says, this is what I'm going to do for 8 years. I'm going to encourage good leaders. I'm going to inspire people in Africa to take up the cudgels of good governance. That's going to be my signature emphasis. And all these other programs come in behind it.
Thank you very much to all of the panel. I don't know if the wine has run out yet, but I think we probably have time for maybe 5 or 10 minutes of questions, which we would probably do and then see which panelists might want to respond. As I listened to this very, very good set of presentations, I heard some common themes that emerged. Obviously, governance did. The problem of focusing on big relationships came out of the discussion. But so did the problem of the Mauritanias and the Guinea-Bissaus. No offense to anybody. the issue of prevention came out in all the different commentaries that were made, the importance of thinking ahead of the crisis rather than waiting for the crisis. Capacity building right here at home, vitally important. Mainstreaming Africa, burden sharing, and not pretending that somehow Africa's future is in American hands. And then finally, a theme that was mentioned briefly, which I think needs a little more attention, is the whole issue of private sector engagement, because the private sector in Africa is a very exciting story, and there are people here in this room who know it far better than I. Are there any microphones around for those who might have a question or two? If so, raise your hand, and we'll get a microphone. And we'll take two or three questions, and then we'll go back to the panel. So, yeah, right here. Go ahead.
Hi. Paul Mutter, Bridging Nations. You had mentioned that Obama's first visit was to Ghana. In the past few years, the People's Republic of China leadership has made a lot of high-profile visits in that region and to other parts of Africa. So all of you had talked about the potentials for economic development and to bringing Africa into global dialogue with other countries, specifically the new energy policies of countries like China. So my question is, in terms of energy policy and also governance, where do you see the possibility for cooperation with the People's Republic of China, and where do you see our interests being at odds and there needs to be more dialogue with China and with specific African countries?
Yes. We talked a little bit about capacity building in the United States. I was wondering what your thoughts were on capacity building efforts in Africa, particularly with respect to trade capacity, strengthening financial institutions. And I also wondered, as a follow-up, what initiatives you feel have been most helpful in that regard. Thanks.
And then we have a question in the front by someone who knows something about trade policy, and maybe he'll answer your question before we have to. So, Steve?
Steve Landy. I shouldn't say this in public, but Chet Cracker and I graduated from Johns Hopkins together with Kendall Walter Kendall, who just got his name in the newspaper for being a Cuban spy. But Walter Kendall Miles, I forgot his last name. But seriously, a quick comment. We very much appreciate. All I know is I bought his house, so they're going to check it out. But seriously, Princeton, we very much appreciate your comment about Manchester Trade tutoring. You tutored us in Africa. But I do believe that the best thing that can happen, if anybody who knows Africa want tutoring on trade, please come to Tony Cowell and I in Manchester Trade. Because the one thing that hasn't been mentioned and absolutely blows my mind, because it's an African initiative, is the steps that are being taken for regional integration. Regional integration, there's no way 48 countries can develop. Regional integration now is so close, it can be an Obama success. In East Africa, there are three regional economic communities, Kumasi, East African Community, and SADC. They now have a tripartite group. In West Africa, Nigeria is, what we say, is two tariff concessions away from joining the French-speaking countries in ECOWAS. One of the things that are missing is a U.S. approach. What Princeton does in his book, and it deserves compliments, is he says, you know, the U.S. doesn't support regional integration because in Africa, because when we go to the WTO, we don't say, oh, there are some WTO rules that actually make regional integration harder to achieve. The European unions are trying to screw things up with their little mercantilist economic partnership agreements. So the way I would simply stop and say, because you can't go on this, and so on. But the way I would simply stop is say, I would hope we give some attention to having another initiative along with food security and the other ones mentioned that really focuses on how we can help really promote economic integration, a very possible accomplishment during the 8 years of President Obama's administration. I don't have to teach you guys anything. It's great.
Thank you, Steve. The panel, who would like to pick up on some of these questions? Floor is open.
Let me address the issue of China-U.S. cooperation in Africa. I wrote the section in the book on that. And if for those of you who haven't yet seen the book, and if you have an interest in that particular topic, about half of what I wrote is actually recommendations for how U.S. and China cooperate. So I won't regurgitate all of those for you. They're easily read. I would simply note that the Chinese effort in Africa in recent years has been absolutely astounding. It has quite frankly, at many levels, surpassed that of the U.S. effort in Africa. And in some countries, at least a half a dozen, maybe up to a dozen, I would argue today that Chinese influence is greater than American influence. Now, admittedly, some of these are countries like Guinea-Bissau that maybe we don't want to have that much influence in, but some of them are not, and they're not all the pariahs. I mean, Sudan and Zimbabwe certainly fall in this category, but there are other countries where clearly the Chinese have equaled or surpassed U.S. influence, and I would say they're gaining ground rather than losing ground. On the issue of regional integration, there's a Chinese element there, too. The Chinese are beginning to take this seriously. They are dealing with not only the ECOWASs and the SADCs of the world, but with the South African Customs Union and the COMESAs of the world. They've got it. They understand it. The Chinese were the ones who hosted the African Development Bank meeting in Shanghai in 2007. They get it. We haven't quite gotten it yet in some respects. There are a lot of areas where we could cooperate with China in Africa, but rather than my regurgitate them, read them in the book.
Yeah, I think just on the energy side, I think there's a tremendous opportunity for cooperation with China because we really have the same interest in stable prices, security of supply, an international market they have access to. I think China has learned that the oil for infrastructure deals were a mistake. None of them actually produced a transaction. They produced a huge backlash for the foreign ministry. Now they're trying to buy supply in the open market. So I think there's a lot of potential there. We have to talk to them about their need, which is energy security, and not just about what's problematic. In terms of standards, they have a different view, and on EITI in particular. They don't buy it. They don't buy our development model, didn't think it worked, think theirs deserves a try. But because their own policy is changing, I think there is a chance to have a conversation about the politics and about stability in the region, and I think we haven't actually had that dialogue on that subject yet. It's all been about climate and other things. So I think there's an opportunity to forge some cooperation there.
I just say one more thing in respect to China and the governance dimension, and that is the official line is this one of mutual respect, and we're not pushing democracy, and you people are, meaning the U.S., and it appears like a divide, but the counter is, and again, to pick up on David's point, and the opportunity for cooperation is that many of their deals are not going to be sustainable unless there is viable states and good governance in this region. So if we segue slightly off of the democratization dimension of governance when dealing specifically with the Chinese, but emphasize state capacity, rule of law in particular, then there may be common ground here where our mutual interests are advanced.
Just a quick word on this question of regional integration. I'm not a trade expert, but it occurs to me that we have no reason certainly to oppose regional integration and no reason not to work to remove obstacles if they exist within the WTO. But just as with other forms of regional integration, whether it's trade or whether it's security assistance, I mean, the impetus really has to come from the Africans themselves. There really has to be a determination that they want these things to happen. We cannot substitute our enthusiasm for greater regional cooperation for, you know, to compensate for maybe ambivalence or reluctance on the part of African states. And I think part of the problem we're seeing is not so much the external obstacles, but it's also the ambivalence on the part of certain governments and a little bit of uncertainty in that regard.
Well, thank you all. You've been a great audience. Please join me in thanking our panel.